In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
And thank you for joining us today here on the I Spy Radio Show. After a couple of weeks off, one was planned, it being Easter weekend, but last week was an unplanned break due to some last-minute problems with our guest schedules. At any rate, it's good to be back with two great guests, and today's show is all about advancing the cause of freedom here in America. And as I said in my speech to the Capital City Republican Women's Luncheon, which we were played last week, we really are at war, and we have to face that. Defending freedom requires a constant state of vigilance, but America right now really is at war with itself. One side wants freedom, the other side wants control. This has always been the way of freedom throughout history. The amount of freedom that we have doesn't increase by people being silent. No one gets more freedom by being compliant. Back in the days of the endless emergency powers of COVID, I said, no society in the history of man has obeyed its way to more freedom. America was founded on rebelling. We didn't get to be free because we obeyed the king. And as we've often said on iSpy Radio, you can't fight what you don't understand. Today is about getting a better understanding of those who oppose freedom, the political left, who, on the one hand, they say they're about rights for individuals and inclusion and no one is above the law and other such grand things, but all of which are really the opposite of what they truly believe. Does anyone think Joe Biden or Hillary Clinton are not above the law? Under the left, there are only collective rights for groups, not individuals, which is why they were so eager and willing to strip individuals of the right to speak up under COVID, slapping the labels of disinformation on people who refused to be silent about COVID, that there were viable treatments that didn't involve spending hundreds of billions of dollars on treatments that didn't work. Shut up, peasant. It's not about health. It's about control. And we can't grab control unless people believe us and you're causing them to lose faith. And we'll also be looking at the DA who indicted Trump to get a better handle on the bureaucracy and structure of prosecutors within the justice system. Are there any breaks on the system? Something to rein in rogue prosecutors? We'll get an insider look at the justice system with our second guest, Curtis Hill, a former attorney general with the state of Indiana. And we'll ask him about a weird case right now of adoption running into full-blown Nazism in Oregon. By the way, anyone else out there think it was a little odd that the left was gleefully trying to crucify Trump during Easter week? Modern-day Pharisees afraid of their power being taken away. Don't you just love irony? Especially when, if the left wasn't completely blind to irony and hypocrisy, it would absolutely make their heads explode. I'd like to welcome now Kevin Slack. He is a professor of politics at Hillsdale College, where he teaches political philosophy and American political thought. And he has a new book out, War on the American Republic, How Liberalism Became Despotism. Definitely something needed for our time. So, Dr. Slack, thanks for joining us today.
It's good to be here.
So regarding your book, War on the American Republic, you actually have an online course available for this as well, and we'll link that up on iSpyRadio.com so people can find that. So Americans often use the words progressive, liberal, and radical more or less interchangeably without really understanding their place in American history, according to the write-up on your book. So why don't you describe those three individual ideologies and how they differ?
Yeah, I think broadly speaking, I don't know if you recall, you go back about 15 years ago, this was a question. You could go online and you'd find conservatives arguing who is farther to the left, the liberals or the progressives. I don't think that's a question anymore, the way we use those words just in, you know, common language today. The liberal means somebody who's in the center. The progressive is somebody who's off to the left. So I think that is true, but I was interested in what's the origin, the genealogy of these words in American history. And so I go back to the original progressive movement from 1880 to 1920. What the end of the progressives was, they were a pretty decent bunch in terms of mores, I mean, the things you could pick out that were flaws. But they're really responsible for the rejection of the old Republican order and the creation of an administrative state or the delegation of lawmaking authority to experts to make decisions supposedly for the common good. The word liberal was a term that was it was a self-identification for those, begins to be used in the United States in the 19-teens. And if you go to FDR and the New Deal and the Great Society, you could say there was a liberal consensus. They rejected some of the foundations of the older progressivism, and for them they wanted a regime of real scientific planning. In other words, scientists would work together with the largest corporations to plan the entire economy, as opposed to the older progressive view of neutral scientists who'd make regulations for private industry. When we talk about progressives today, they really don't have much in common with the older progressives, or you'd have to go back quite far. The new progressives were the self-proclaimed radicals who rose up against those mid-century liberals. I like to describe them as the Leave It to Beaver liberals, because that's kind of, you know, my grandparents, that's the generation they grew up in. And the radicals of the late 60s really challenged the liberals, their views of America. And they would introduce even more radical policies, but in different areas. So, for example, an attack on the traditional family through the use of these new institutions. This idea of equity, that now it was going to be governmental policy, not just to be colorblind in the older mid-century liberal sense, but to try to get involved in private business, corporations, and in government to make sure that we treated people differently on the basis of skin color to achieve some broader view of equity or justice. So I think those are the, you know, progressive, liberal, radical. Those are the words that I try to get to the bottom of. And interestingly, if you go to those radicals of the 60s and into the 1970s, they're the same people in the 1990s, oftentimes, that we associate with identity politics. So all those systems of you know, proceeding from a kind of critical theory, we get to systemic racism, or if we get to systemic genderism, all those systems are rounded out in the 70s. The idea of triggering somebody, the idea of confessing your white privilege. And so they've been around a very, very long time. It was only in the 2000-teens that this became the new authority as large corporations align themselves with what I call a priesthood.
In terms of right or left ideology, do all three of those, certainly the radicals are on the left, but were the progressives and liberals, were they also always on the left, or did like the liberals kind of start on the right and move left?
It's a great question. They were all, I would say, on the left at that time period. The liberals, they were more centrist, and most of the conservatives that come out of the late 60s in many ways are just the older liberals who were, you know, and this is often the common claim about movement conservatism, that the neocons, the neoconservatives, were often those who were the old liberals who were disillusioned by the new left that initially they had kind of welcomed and thought that would lead in a different direction. And so they walk back, right, you could say their liberalism, and they start to call themselves conservative. Let me give you an example real quick. Sure. Something like being very patriotic, right? So those mid-century liberals, think about a Robert F. Kennedy, John F. Kennedy. They're very much in favor of the Cold War, of containment, trying to stop the Soviet Union. And so when you have those in the Democratic Party, a group of radicals that really takes over the party through the McGovern Commission after the 1968 DNC, and you have a very different, more radical platform in 72 and in 76, many of those who would consider themselves liberals are going to break with the more radical Democratic Party, and some of them even calling themselves conservatives afterwards.
Hmm. Okay, let's go and take a break. We'll have more with Kevin Slack. He is a professor of politics at Hillsdale College. He has a new book out, War on the American Republic, How Liberalism Became Despotism. We'll continue with him next. And welcome back. This is the I Spy Radio Show. Talking today to Dr. Kevin Slack. He's a professor of politics at Hillsdale College, and he has a new book out there, War on the American Republic, How Liberalism Became Despotism. And we are certainly seeing that all over the place nowadays here in America. Heaven forbid you actually disagree with leftist ideology. And so speaking of leftist ideology, we have seen Marxism fail time and again, bringing misery and poverty rather than prosperity. And studies have now proven that go woke, go broke is a real world consequence of businesses pushing leftist ideology. They really do go broke. Disney lost like $123 billion last year. Trump is right when he says everything woke turns to you know what. So why do the adherents of liberalism and progressivism and radicals, why do they continue to cling to leftist ideology when there's so much evidence of its failure all around them?
Well, I mean, I think one straightforward answer to that question is because it is a religion, you're not going to disabuse somebody by claims to utility. In fact, the claims of utility may even further entrench their own religious views. What comes to mind is those who want to take only interest in mind in negotiations between those of different religious positions, for example, Muslim radicals. What they find is that actually appeal to interest that insults those participants. I think it's something similar here. You're not going to convince somebody on the left who has a fervent religious belief that gives them and their life meaning. You're not going to convince them because it is not efficient in economic terms that it's somehow false. I would also say that one of the key components of this what's called the Great Awakening, this alliance between large corporations and diversity, equity, and inclusion that explodes after the 2008 housing market crisis, is that this is part of a growing monopoly capitalism. One example that is recent is Bud Light. You wonder the kinds of people that come through these gateways to power, right? The Ivy League institutions, large research universities, and they bring with them their own opinions and beliefs. Why would Bud Light have put Dylan Mulvaney on the cover of one of its cans? Well, one answer is that the last time I checked, there were two corporations that controlled 90% of the beer that Americans drink. And so they can afford to lose money, and that even if you boycott Bud Light, there's certainly other Anheuser-Busch products you're probably buying without even noticing it. So if you can get a monopoly status or large market share through these kinds of connections, I think that you can shrug off the attempted boycotts by some of your conservative buyers.
We often hear that our founding fathers wouldn't recognize what America has become. What about the founders of these particular movements, especially liberalism, which you say was kind of more centrist? Would they recognize where liberalism has ended up today?
That's a great question. When I think of, those mid-century liberals, many of them would they recognize it? I think many of them did oppose those on the radical left, or they tried to make their peace with them. I think what you find in moving outside of that or away from that liberal mid-century movement was something that's called neoliberalism. And I think there's been a lot of difficulty in identifying what neoliberalism is. And if I would say there's one reason to read the book, my book, is because I think I try to lay it out in a pretty fair way, you find in the Democratic Party a move back to the center among those in the party, in control of the party. And they are often rejecting what they call the bleeding heart liberal policies. By this, they meant the big fiscal policy of the 60s. And so if you go to the 1980s, you have the phenomenon of the new Democrats, right? This is Bill Clinton, Gary Hart. And it's hard to remember how much of a superstar Gary Hart was for 15 minutes. Bill Bradley or Paul Tsongas, Al Gore was one of them. They were arguing for free markets. They were arguing for what they Lester Thoreau had called the zero-sum society. And that meant that we wanted to deregulate. Remember, most of the deregulation occurs under Jimmy Carter in the late 70s. So I think that those older liberals did oppose what they saw to be politically imprudent positions by the radicals. But the radicals, there was a place for them, and they ensconced themselves in the universities and in bureaucracy. There's a wonderful old piece written by this guy, Bill Poole, at the Heritage Foundation. I think it was written something like 1978 or 9. And it's called something like the New Left, Where Are They Now? And he just goes through and he shows how all these leftist radicals in the 60s had gotten positions in government or in various think tanks and so on. So I do think there's a divide between those centrist liberals and the 60s radicals. And what's interesting is how there's been a kind of reunification, again, getting back to the 2010s. One hearkening back to some of those older views would be this Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who's just announced his candidacy in the Democratic primary for president.
You had said in another interview that one of the most common questions that you get is, what has happened to my country? So, let's maybe spend some time looking at how we got here. How did we get here? How did they manage to gain so much power within America?
I think what people most of the time, what they mean by that is what happened to some of the basic virtues that held American society together?
Right.
What happened to hard work, industry, frugality, some of those virtues we were talking about off air, right, that we associate with Benjamin Franklin? And I think one of the most important changes has been the destruction of the family. And I think
yes.
you can go back and look at institutional changes. I don't think this was some kind of an accident. Usually we'll get say, the economy alone, and we say, well, this was all inevitable. Or we look at birth control and we say, well, this was inevitable. I don't think that's the case. At least I'm not persuaded of it. I think that there were real cultural changes and that there were many
yes.
who wanted to attack the institution of the family. In my book, I kind of go through some detail about some of the radicals, Herman Hill Kay, who played a large role in writing the model No-Fault Divorce Act that was adopted by almost all the states. I think 49 states by 1983 or 4, and the creation of a family court system that was dominated by many who were leftist. And their whole point was social activism. How is it that we can destroy what they saw to be an oppressive institution? And so you see the divorce rates skyrocket. Divorce, particularly spiked during World War II, but then it levels off around 1950, in the early 50s, 20%, still high, right? One out of every five marriages. But after the no-fault divorce laws, it skyrockets to 50% in the 80s. And now we're at the point where I think 42% of all births are illegitimate, and you have most adults are single. And so there's a real crisis of the family. How are you going to have decent citizens if they don't have a model of the father in the
right,
home, which
right.
is representative for order in the world itself. And I think that's when people say, what happened in my country? They think of that. They think, well, what happened to basic manners? And there are other things I think they mean by that as well. If you go back to the mid-century liberals, right, one thing you can say about them, and I think this has been distorted through much of our histories, is that they really aspired to what they saw to be a colorblind society, right? This was, if you look at the 1964 Civil Rights Act, that was a partnership between Republicans and Democrats in the North, and in their view, they were going to punish whites in the South. And the whole intention of that bill was we were going to achieve a colorblind society. And if you just watched television in the 1980s, you would see that in all the various shows. Think about the Cosby Show, right? So here's this show that's a headliner. I grew up watching it. And now they look at society, and everything seems to be based on racial division and tribalism, even to the point where the president is trying to exacerbate these differences that blow up into violence. And then you have the media covering over these acts. Consider here the transgender murder of the children recently in a school, where we still don't have the manifesto of this trans person who decided to shoot kids. So I think that's also what they mean. Why is it we went from a colorblind society, one that recognized the differences between the sexes, to one in which we're trying to do away with
right.
Even female spaces altogether, and we're trying to inflame racial hatred?
Yeah, it's amazing the shift that has happened, but especially amazing how quickly all of this has happened as well. Okay, time for a break. We'll have more with Kevin Slack. He's a professor of politics at Hillsdale College. His new book is War on the American Republic, How Liberalism Became Despotism. More after this. And welcome back. We're talking today to Kevin Slack. He's a professor of politics at Hillsdale College, and he teaches political philosophy and American political thought there. He also has a new book, War on the American Republic, How Liberalism Became Despotism, and there's also a free online course on that subject that you can take. We'll link that up on iSpyRadio.com. Just look for today's show page. That's 1316. And so we were talking on the way out there about how we got here and also what has really helped these leftist ideologies seize so much control. And it seems to me one of the things that they did successfully was to remove religion and especially Christianity from society. And there's this kind of notion that, oh, you shouldn't be pushing your religion and ideology on other people. Meanwhile, the left was busy pushing their ideology and religion on other people. So did they take control or at least aided in that effort because those on the right stayed silent about their own beliefs?
Yes, I think so. I think one important foundational point is that every political regime needs some kind of religious legitimacy. you know, you go back to the Declaration of Independence, and it appeals to the laws of nature and nature's God. And if you see all the ways, even in the founding period, that these various states supported religion directly or indirectly, there are a whole bunch of them. And one of the most important ways is the way that has been under assault for years now, and that is giving tax-exempt status to churches. If that's repealed, of course, the design would be to make many of those institutions fold. So I think that if we recognize that every regime has to claim some legitimacy and consider why, right? You need citizens who are willing to make sacrifices for the community. And so you need to appeal to something that's more important than life itself. If you go into any elementary school, the walls are covered with religious paraphernalia, right? You have ideas of saving the planet, saving right. the whales, environmentalism, equity, right? The silhouettes of Martin Luther King Jr. And so these were very much religious teachings. And in the late 60s, you find anti-racism. Martin Luther King Jr. was probably the greatest prophet of that. He was very, very radical. I give examples in my book. I think conservatives want to believe that MLK was more conservative. And so we've actually forgotten about some of the conservatives in the civil rights movement or those who were farther to the right. One great example of that quick is Joseph H. Jackson, who broke with Martin Luther King Jr. at the National Baptist Convention. Literally, it was a schism in that convention. Hmm. So you have this new system that's very religious and gives people a sense of meaning and purpose. And this is channeled in all the ways you would find religious sentiments expressed. On the one hand, you have this this teaching of ethics, right? How ought I to live my life? How can I be in harmony with myself? And you teach these children these horrific stories, the slavery, the Holocaust. It gives them this sense of guilt, these white children, and so they're looking for penance, and they need to confess their white privilege. It's all the things that you would find in a Catholic confessional. But then there's also other ways that you can channel the desire for religious expression, such as social justice, the duties that you have. Once you have a monopoly over someone's identity, now you can teach them certain privileges and duties that accompany that identity, and that's what we've done to different groups. It's the antithesis of republicanism and equality under the law. And then, of course, one more religious teaching we have is climate change, this idea that you're going to save the planet. There's a kind of neo-paganism that really begins in the 1960s. You know, when Ken Burns, the PBS documentary series, says that our national parks are our temples, that's not some kind of an exaggeration or hyperbole. He means that. Go back and watch the first minute of Al Gore's An Inconvenient Truth, and you get that notion of religiosity from environmentalism. So I think this is religious. I think that Christians have assumed for decades now that if they were just tolerant of other opinions, they'd be tolerated themselves, and this is completely false. Rather, they tolerated those who demanded toleration, and now they find they're not being tolerated themselves. And I think now they have a real choice. It is either they're going to continue to capitulate, and I see this in every Christian denomination where they think if they just adopt anti-racism, then they'll be left alone, that they'll be okay. And the only other choice is for them to actually find their true principles and stand their ground and to be willing to sacrifice for it. The young men that I see coming through Hillsdale, the ones that have gone off to seminary and come back either for the grad program or to finish an undergrad education, what they're telling me is that when you go to these seminaries, they're dominated by leftist ideology.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, that doesn't surprise me at all. I think the left knows that's where our weakness is, so of course that's where you're going to attack. And in terms of, we've only got a couple minutes here, actually about a minute and a half here with you. How do we stop this? Is it a matter of legislation and law, or is it more something that must arise from society?
I'll say both. First of all, there needs to be some kind of a return to an original faith.
Yes.
That if conservatives can't, you know, one thing I always tell the students is that all morality is aggression, right? All morality is aggression. What I mean by that is to be a moral human being, you have to have the confidence to shame other people and to say you're wrong. And that's what you see on the left. If there's any kind of a battle over books in a library, right, something any decent person would oppose, you'll notice that the people, the rainbow crowd, they show up in mass. And they show up in mass collectively, and they have this confidence to act out, to act very uncivilly, and to try to shame other people. I'm not saying that conservatives need to you know, need to act in similar fashion, but they need to have the confidence to say, you're wrong. And I think that's lacking in many ways. So they need to go back and find out what's vital about their way of life and their traditions. And then they need to have the confidence to impose it. For some reason, when it comes to, for example, hires in bureaucracy or the professorate or education, conservatives always want to move to the center and say, well, it's about neutrality. It's about neutral competence when we hire somebody, instead of realizing, no, this is about placing your friends. One thing I've said in other interviews is the Democrats have to win elections because they need to pay off their constituents.
Yes.
So they have they're not deluded about what elections are about. And I think if conservatives are going to survive this at the local level and at the state level in particular, they need to double down on what it is they believe and how they're going to implement that in law.
Yes. And then once they do get into power, they really need to cut off that money spigot to the left. Unfortunately, we are up against the clock. Dr. Kevin Slack, he's a professor of politics at Hillsdale College. His new book is War on the American Republic, How Liberalism Became Despotism, and we'll link that up on iSpyRadio.com as well as links to his free course on that. Dr. Slack, I want to thank you so much for your time. We look forward to having you back sometime.
Thank you very much.
Project 21 Ambassador Curtis Hill Jr. was the 43rd Attorney General of the state of Indiana. He is also a lawyer, consultant, speaker, and author advancing the cause of freedom in America. And I'd like to welcome him now to the show. Curtis, it's great to talk to you. Thanks for being here.
Mark, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. So as I said, you were the Attorney General for Indiana. Talk to us about your background and especially your time there. For example, I understand you made fighting corruption a priority while you were there. Was that mainly corruption inside of government or criminal corruption on the outside of government or a bit of both?
Well, it was a bit of both. I started off as a prosecutor. I was a prosecuting attorney, 14 years a deputy and 14 years as the elected prosecutor. And it's really all about truth and justice. And wherever you find corruption, you can find corruption within government units. You can find corruption within the community. The idea is to strip it out and provide solid justice for all. And one of the things that we've been seeing more and more of increasingly is this concept of social justice as opposed to what I call ordinary constitutional justice.
We did want to have you on to talk about the Manhattan DA, Alvin Bragg, and his indictment of President Trump, and we'll get to that in the next segment. But, you know, we see people like Bragg going after Trump or a massively corrupt district attorney, Kim Gardner in St. Louis, Missouri, who lied about evidence and yet has not really been held responsible, and not to mention the corruption that we see within the FBI for politics. So why is it so hard to remove corrupt individuals within the justice system itself? From the outside looking in, I would think that rooting out corruption would be one of, if not the top priorities of the justice system.
Well, it should be the top priority of the justice system, because once the integrity of the system is lost, public confidence wanes. And so it's imperative that those who are at the top of the system work to ferret out corruption wherever they can. But the difficulties are that the people are human, and lawyers are human, and judges are human, and so you have human failings. Mm. And in particular areas, it's not unheard of for someone to abuse the authority that they have, the trust that they have from the people, and it's very difficult to address. I know that in some situations I've heard, well, we need to put somebody above the Attorney General for New York. Well, if the Attorney General for New York has to answer to someone else, how do we know that someone else is not corrupt? There's always that opportunity for the next layer, the next person to be corrupt. The best way to address it is by the citizenry to pay attention to what's going on around them, to hold their public officials accountable. And if there's no way to address it during that cycle, then certainly at the time that the election comes up, people need to remember what they bargained for.
Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned having somebody above someone like Bragg. And before we get to him, help us understand the bureaucratic system a bit better in terms of district attorneys and attorneys general and so on. When a prosecutor such as Bragg gets elected, are they just all sort of loose cannons out there who can go off and pursue whomever they want? Or does someone have oversight over them? And if so, who does have oversight?
Well, the prosecuting attorney's office and the position is one of the most powerful positions in elected politics, more so than a congressman, a senator, and I would even say the president of the United States. And the reason is that the prosecutor has unfettered discretion to file criminal charges, or in other words, to take someone's liberty away without a whole lot of interference. Now, there are checks and balances to the system, but aside from those checks and balances, the prosecutor's authority is very, very strong. That's why it's important. That's why it's important to pay attention to who you're electing as prosecutor, because it can be a dangerous weapon in the hands of the wrong person. The reason that you don't want to have someone overseeing is the buck has to stop with someone. And as I mentioned, that someone may be someone who is they themselves corrupt. So it's not like you can just we're going to make the prosecutor report to someone else. Well, that someone else might be corrupt. So the bottom line is, we respect the fact that prosecutors have a full measure of discretion. I support prosecutor discretion. What I don't support is prosecutor abuse of discretion, where they, for personal reasons, target individuals, or for personal reasons, disregard the state legislature and what the legislature thought was an appropriate sanction or law.
So what is the accountability within the system? For example, let's say that somebody is truly corrupt. They violate the law. They, you know, in the case of Kim Gardner, who was hiding evidence or claimed she had evidence, and then it turned out she didn't. We've seen cases of where, in fact, in Trump's case, where they've planted evidence. They did that during the Russia collusion. What's the accountability there? I mean, for someone who is corrupt, what's the remedy?
Well, if there's enough information to apply a criminal standard, there can still be investigations by law enforcement dealing with criminal corruption. In terms of political influence and the like, that's a little bit more difficult. It's much more tricky to deal with the personal relationships and the influences that go into the process. And so the best remedy for that is the light of day, making sure that the public is aware of the levels of corruption, and making sure that around election time, if not able to address it sooner, address it at election time and throw the rascals out.
Okay, let's go ahead and take a break there. When we come back, we'll continue our talk with Curtis Hill. He's a former Attorney General for Indiana, and he's ambassador for Project 21 as well. We'll ask him about that Manhattan DA who indicted President Trump. Curtis Hill Jr. was the 43rd Attorney General of the state of Indiana. He is now a Project 21 ambassador, lawyer, consultant, speaker, and author, doing his part to advance the cause of freedom in America. He has a lot of great articles out there on such things as election integrity, stopping the weaponization of race, restoring law and order, and lots more. And we're going to put a link to those on today's show page, which is 13-16, which you can find on iSpyRadio.com. And one of those articles appeared on Monday this week in the Washington Times, titled "Abusing Prosecutorial Power is Nothing to Brag About." Okay, so that's really at the heart of what we had wanted to talk to you about, this Manhattan DA, Alvin Bragg, and his indictment of President Trump. And you say that Bragg or other district attorneys like him are realigning the criminal justice system, that, quote, social justice prosecutors won't be bound by the ordinary standards of prosecutorial discretion grounded in the Constitution. Instead, DAs like Mr. Bragg will unilaterally determine the desired corrections to the system. So, if the law is only what one person says is the law, then there really is no law, it seems. I mean, you just have a series of petty dictators, don't you?
That's exactly what you have. You have a system that breaks down, and justice for all becomes justice for some, or justice for the preferred. And that's exactly what the objective is by these social justice prosecutors. This is a concerted effort by the deep left to identify individuals, lawyers, and whenever possible, black lawyers, to place them in the roles of DAs, fund them heavily, get them in a position to be DAs in these big cities. And then if there are laws that the left feels are not appropriate, rather than doing the customary thing where you elect legislative representatives who go in and debate and change the law, you simply put prosecutors in who ignore the law. And that's what we're seeing in these large jurisdictions. So a prosecutor comes in, and rather than being bound by the Constitution, they're bound by their own conscience. And if they have no conscience, then anything can happen. You can choose to charge somebody because you don't like them. You can choose to let someone go because you do like them. And that's the level of corruption that we're seeing in many of these big cities. And you're seeing that play out in real time in the Alvin Bragg scenario.
You know, to coin a phrase, it sounds like we've entered the era of interpretive justice, where we just have...
No, you're exactly right. I mean, we're used to, Mark, we're used to the presumption of innocence. Mm-hmm. Someone is accused of a crime, presumption of innocence, law enforcement does its thing, and we have a justice system that ferrets out the truth. Here's what's happened in the last few years. You have someone who's accused, bam, they're guilty.
Yes.
It's not about the justice system anymore. It's about social media. It's about PR. It's about the broad brush of accusation. So in this particular case, people have asked me, well, how does this play out? What's the likelihood of Trump being convicted, et cetera? And I say, that's not the issue. That's not the point. They didn't file the charge to necessarily convict Trump. It's a ridiculous charge in the first place. They filed the charge to prove that they could, to get him on his heels, to demonstrate what kind of power they have to chill the effect of this particular former president and future former presidents or anyone else. Certainly no one is above the law. We hear that over and over and over again. But Mark, no one is below the law.
That's right.
The law is a standard that we establish to treat people fairly. And I'm not here to say that it's always been the case that every single person within the justice system has been treated fairly. In fact, we all know that injustice has occurred over and over and over again amongst many different groups and individuals. But that doesn't mean that once you get the type of power that a prosecutor has, it's your responsibility to correct an injustice through another injustice. That's what we have to stop.
Yeah, and I certainly agree with you that I think a lot of this was done simply to create the appearance of guilt. Because I'm sure you probably run into it quite a bit, that people hear the word indictment and they assume that means he is in fact guilty, rather than he's been accused of doing something.
Well, it's very similar to the political process where someone is impeached. Mm-hmm. When you hear that someone is impeached, you think they've been removed from office. Well, impeachment really means you've been charged, and it's not until the Senate conducts a hearing and convicts you that it makes a difference. But to the civilized world, impeachment means something. Same thing here in the criminal process. Indicting or charging someone with a crime can be as threatening and as bad as a potential conviction. So just stirring this pot is certainly enough. And particularly when you look at, this was a factual circumstance that's really, as I've described, a tawdry tabloid story.
Yes.
That's over 5 years old, that a predecessor prosecutor passed on, that the Department of Justice was not interested in. And this is not a friendly Department of Justice to Trump.
No.
Nor was the previous Manhattan DA a friend of Trump. These were people who looked at the case and applied what prosecutors have to apply within their discretion. That's called the so what rule. Whereas you have a circumstance, you can piece together a prosecution. You can prosecute anybody for anything if you've worked on it hard enough. But at some point, you have to step back and say, is this really in the interest of justice? Does this really matter? Or in other words, so what?
Yeah.
And you really have to ask yourself, how many people are out there, other than the fact that they're clamoring to see Trump go down, how many people are really looking at this offense and saying, oh, this was something that needed to be charged because ABC?
Yeah.
I don't think you have anybody recognizing this as a sinister event that required engagement by the Manhattan DA.
Well, certainly we know that these kinds of payments have been made by pretty much every politician out there, it seems. So why aren't you going after all of them rather than just the one? But it does matter if politics is your priority. You know, let's actually go ahead and take a break there. Coming back, we'll have more with Curtis Hill. There's a weird case in Nazi Oregon, and how do we fix an unjust justice system? Stay with us. It's all been about advancing freedom today on the iSpy Radio Show, first with Kevin Slack and his book, War on America, and now with Curtis Hill, a former Attorney General for Indiana. Just a reminder that if you missed anything or want to listen again or want to share it with someone, the podcast version will be available starting Mondays on your favorite podcast platform. Just look for iSpy Radio Show, and today's show is 13-16. And so going on to that break there was something I really wanted to follow up with you on in terms of Bragg. and doing this mainly for political reasons, you know, because allegedly one of the reasons the FBI refused to prosecute Hillary, they were claiming it would be interfering with the election. They then proceeded to interfere with the 2016 election by spying on Trump and then hamstringing his first 2 years as president by the Russia collusion investigation, and then interfered with the 2020 election by not investigating the Hunter laptop, which they had and sat on for over a year. So how is what Bragg is doing not election interference?
Kind of convenient how they pull that off, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
it's a matter of when it's for us, we do this. When it's against us, we do that. And that's exactly the case. The timing of this thing is spectacular. A few weeks after the former president announced that he's running for re-election, and we're going to drag this information that has been in the public eye for quite some time. And it's really amazing when they're going to use as their star witness the president's former fixer, who's got credibility issues all over the place. I mean, it's a prime example of the abuse of the system by those who are in power to choose to do what they want to do when it suits them. And I think even it's so bad, Mark, that even some Democrats who don't like Trump, who don't like anything about him, look at what this is doing to the system and are aghast, because ultimately the justice system is there to preserve the rest of our freedoms. And you are, as you know, our freedoms are under assault by the left on a continuous basis. And this is just a part of that process.
Sure. And, the dangerous thing about using the justice system as a weapon is that eventually that weapon can be turned on you. And I think the more sane Democrats realize that. So
we call that what's good for the goose is good for the gander.
I'm pretty sure that's the exact legal term as well.
Yes.
So do you, as someone who has worked in the justice system, and especially as a former attorney general, do you believe that we truly do have a two-tier justice system where Republicans and Democrats are treated very differently, or is it really just a matter of subjective perception and it just feels that way?
Well, I think we're having a divide in our nation altogether. I mean, I used to say that we were a country divided. I feel like we've become two complete separate nations.
Yes, it does feel
that way. And so within those separate nations, we're having separate justice systems. If you would ask me, for example, what's the likelihood of Trump being treated fairly in this case? Well, it kind of depends, because if we go to the legal system that I grew up in, this case goes nowhere and gets tossed out on its ear on an early motion. But if we look at the justice system for what it's become or what it's becoming, anything's possible because the system has lost its integrity.
Mm. Well, like I said, interpretive justice system. There's this here in Oregon, we have this weird situation where a state agency has decided that you can't be a foster parent or adopt if you as a parent don't support a child's wish to be a different gender. And that includes genital mutilation and all the rest of things. So a woman recently had her application denied because as a devout Christian, she said she could not and would not support that. Our thoughts on this is that it creates an extremely dangerous and even icy slope. Now, according to them, you must believe as the state does or you are excluded from society. I mean, this is Nazism at its finest. What are your thoughts on the state imposing their belief systems on others? I can't imagine this would pass legal muster if they said that you had to be Baptist now in order to adopt.
It's absolutely crazy. It is classic unequal protection under the law. We're telling someone that is going to adopt a child and be that child's parent that you as a parent can't make parental decisions because you don't agree with our ideological viewpoint as a state. That's crazy. Mark, as a parent, you have the ability to determine what's in the best interest of your own child. Why should that be different if you adopt a child versus you have a biological child? Once you become a parent, you have that authority. And that's what's incredible about a rule like that in Oregon or anyone else or anywhere else that's taking that authority away from parents. And in other words, prohibiting this woman from adopting a child solely because she has a faith or a viewpoint or an ideology that's different than the state. It's a classic example of a violation of the Equal Protection Clause.
Hmm. Well, I know that the state is being sued over this, and I certainly hope that the justice system does, in fact, have some justice left to it. Getting back to the justice system, is there a way to fix, I mean, is the way to fix this for Republicans to treat Democrats the way they treat Republicans? So somebody should now indict Biden and Hunter and all the rest, or do we just roll over and hope that they that the left learns to be kind to Republicans? What are your thoughts going forward?
I wouldn't say that we roll over, but I do caution us to engage in the tit for tat, which has been the historical answer in politics. You guys did this to us, so we're going to do it back to you.
Right.
And that just continues an erosion of the system on and on and on. What has to happen is conservatives, Republicans have to be strengthened by what's occurring and be in a position to speak truthfully and objectively about what's occurring and gather support for the coming storm. There are battles to be fought, and those battles are fought around truth. And so it's our job to make sure that we understand truth, that we live out the truth, that we speak the truth and develop the truth to as many people as possible, and not follow suit and say, we're going to do this because you did that. Somebody's got to rise above this and protect and preserve the justice system. And I'm hoping that the side I'm on will be the bigger man in this picture and continue to fight from a truth standpoint as opposed to sinking into the same hole and pit that the other side has fallen into.
Yeah, well, I certainly hope so, because they have certainly exposed who they really are and what they really want to do now, for sure. Curtis Hill, I want to thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Mark. I appreciate it.
Be sure to check out our website. That's iSpyRadio.com for some of the research that went into this week's show, in addition to our guest articles and books and some great speeches. You'll also find the link to Kevin Slack's free online course from Hillsdale based on his book, War on the American Republic. Hillsdale is really a unique college, perhaps the most non-woke school in America, based entirely on teaching courses from a pro-America, pro-Christian perspective. If you have a child graduating soon, maybe you ought to check them out. Education is how we will get America out of this mess, and it starts here in places like Oregon. We have a chance this next year to put school choice on the ballot and make it part of our Constitution to stop legislators from trying to take it away, and we'll be talking about that next week. This is an opportunity for generational change in Oregon. Indoctrination or education? Freedom or what we currently are on the fast track to, full-blown Marxism, unless we stand up to it. Stand up for what you believe. Staying silent never won any wars, because as we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.